Welcome to the 242nd Annual Meeting of the New York Society Library. I'm Charles Berry, the Chairman of the Board. And the first order of business is to call for the election of a chairperson and secretary of the meeting. It doesn't explain on this sheet exactly how that's to be accomplished, but I think perhaps I am the chairperson of the meeting and that Sarah is the secretary. Here she is. Thank you, Sarah. Am I the chairperson of the meeting and you're the secretary?
Yes.
Okay. Perhaps we could, by voice vote, have that happen if everybody would indicate whether they are in favor of that. Any opposed? No. Okay, very good. So I will declare that the polls are open for the election of 10 trustees for the class of 2012 as follows. Lawrence Bergreen, trustee since 2007, William Dean, trustee since 1989, Shirley Hazard, trustee since 1974, Ellen Eisenman, trustee since 2007, Anthony Nur, trustee since 1984, Jean Parker Pfeiffer, trustee since 1992, Theodore C. Rogers, trustee since 1995, Daniel M. Rossner, trustee since 2002, Betty Kelly Sargent, who has served as trustee just for a few months, and this is her first nomination for election to a full term, and Barbara H. Stanton, trustee since 1988. I would like to declare as inspectors of the election John K. Howitt and Jane Goldstein, and ballots are being distributed to those who have not already sent in proxies. And with that, I guess we will all be voting while I present my report as chairman. I'm very pleased to report how the library is doing from my perspective and to express my appreciation for some of the many people whose dedication and contributions make the library the vibrant institution that it continues to be. Last year at this time, the stock markets were just beginning to show signs of life after one of their bleakest periods. Our portfolio has now recovered quite well, although not to the levels it enjoyed before the onset of the financial crisis. What has been most heartening, however, is the buoyancy of spirit that has guided our library and its members and staff during this time. And the events that have shaken our world have caused us all to reflect on the priorities in our lives, and it is refreshing to appreciate how important the New York Society Library is for all of us. Our staff, under the leadership of Mark Bartlett, has shown energy, intelligence, and enthusiasm in guiding our members into the digital age while ensuring our enjoyment of the books in our thoughtfully selected collection. We have expanded our programs to include a wide range of authors and subjects, and even theatrical and musical events. Our physical plant, while at times and in places straining to capacity, is well maintained, and we are pursuing prudent plans to maximize the use of our space. I'd like to mention a few developments of particular interest. Although we are still holding in reserve our ambitious plans to build out the sixth floor, for which we have all necessary city agency approvals, but not yet the necessary funding, we will proceed this summer with some important projects. First, we will fill in the light well spaces on the third, fourth, and fifth floors, expanding the usable area on each of those floors and enabling us to implement a more rational design on each floor. Light wells, as I think all of you know, are about 15 times 20 feet in size, and they will not only give us that additional space, but enable us to use the space on those floors much more effectively. On the fifth floor, which has become increasingly popular with our member writers, we will be able to have six private writing rooms and increase by eight the number of spaces in the main writing room. The building out of the Lightwell and refurbishing of the fifth floor is made possible through the great generosity of the Marshall Hornblower Trust, through the good offices of Mr. Hornblower's daughter, Jenny Lawrence, our former board member, who continues to dedicate enormous creativity, energy, and resources to programs aimed at promoting the work of writers. We look forward to celebrating completion of the fifth floor improvements after the end of the summer and all that Jenny and her father's trust have done for writers and other users of the library. The other important capital project we plan to undertake this summer is the installation of handicapped access in our main entrance stairway. This has been a particularly challenging design issue, but our architects, under the capable supervision of Gene Pfeiffer, chair of our Building and Renovation Committee, and fellow architect and board member Byron Bell, have found a solution. Over the summer, we will install a wheelchair lift along the west wall of the entrance in a manner aimed to preserve the graceful flow of the marble steps while facilitating easy access to those unable to climb the stairs. This long overdue improvement is entirely underwritten by the bequest of the estate of Marion Naumberg, about which we reported last year, and it will provide a resource that all of our members will applaud. These improvements are to be built out during the summer months. We will have to close the library for at least a few weeks. I'm not sure exactly how long, particularly while the entrance is made handicapped accessible. We will make every effort to minimize disruption and ask the forbearance of our members while these important improvements are undertaken. I should note that the filling in of the light rails on the third and fourth floors will, for now, provide only raw, unfinished space on those two floors. Our hope is to attract funding to enable us to build them out with finished space, to expand the children's library on the third floor and the offices of our staff on the fourth. Both are significant priorities for us, and we are working to make these realities within our budget constraints. While I am on the subject of the children's library, let me mention how active that has been under the capable guidance of our children's librarian, Carrie Silberman. Not only has there been significantly greater usage of the children's library and circulation of children's books in recent years, but our sponsorship of the groundbreaking outreach program, Project Cicero, continues to provide hundreds of thousands of books for public school classrooms. In March, I had the pleasure of observing firsthand the enterprising operation whereby our volunteers and scores of others assemble and organize by topic and, and age level huge numbers of books for distribution to public school classroom teachers. In the ballroom and adjacent spaces of the Hotel Pennsylvania across 7th Avenue from Penn Station, the books are arranged on tables and categories such as history, biography, and fiction, and the school teachers line up to have an hour or so to select books of interest to their students, and then they pack them up in suitcases with wheels and cart them off. Our board member Susan Robbins is one of the founders of this project and continues to oversee the operations with Carrie Silberman and others. The spirit is wonderfully cheerful and positive, but everybody is busy and productive, and the project is executed with the precision of a well-oiled machine. The spirit of this important civic undertaking exemplifies the dedication and service that our staff shows in their hard work for our members. They are the key to providing a sense of community for all of us. It is not just that we provide a place to get away that is regularly described as a refuge and a haven and an oasis. We are not an isolated cave or tropical island, but a kind of comfortable academy populated by like-minded searchers and tactful guides who know our tastes and needs. They preserve our distinguished heritage while directing us to a better understanding of our present world. And this past year has given me a deeper appreciation, not only of the sense of belonging to the library that our staff promotes for our members, but also the strong ties among our staff that underline the sense of community that they share. Their support for one another during difficult times has been brought home to me on several occasions, and we are indeed fortunate to have a staff that cares as much as they do for one another as they do for the library and its members to whom they give such thoughtful service. The leadership of Mark Bartlett, with the help of Jane Goldstein, has fostered the spirit of the library that makes us feel at home here. I would also like to acknowledge the dedication of our board, which, as I have said before, it is a great privilege and pleasure to know and work with. It is heartening to have a common bond of love of books and culture and expanding one's intellectual horizons, as all of our board members do. This past year, we were pleased to welcome a new member to the board, Betty Sargent, who is, as I think most of you know, a very accomplished author, editor. She has been the editor-in-chief of William Morrow. She's been at HarperCollins, and she was formerly the chairman of the board at our sister institution, the Mercantile Library. She brings great energy and enthusiasm, which has already been evident in the last few months. Betty replaced our longtime board member, Connie Rogers Roosevelt, who helped establish and then for many years headed our New York City Book Awards Committee, which is focused on one of the library's great strengths as a repository of books written in and about our great city. We thank Connie for all of her hard work and support, and know she will continue to be a dedicated and appreciative user of the library as she pursues graduate studies at Columbia in conservation biology. There are too many others I would like to acknowledge, but I would be remiss if I did not single out our treasurer, George Frelinghuysen, who has also kindly assumed the task of heading our development committee. We have had great success on that front with the able help of Joan Zemet and Diane Srebnick, and I think it's fair to say that the mentality of our members has shifted in a dramatic and wonderful way to recognizing the library as an institution worthy of philanthropy. Bill Dean has played an important role in this and assumed the chair of the newly formed Goodhue Society, which honors those who have provided for the library in their wills and estate planning, and the number of those is remarkable and quite wonderful. Last week, I attended an interesting talk by Alice Prochaska, who is stepping down as the university librarian of the rich and diverse libraries at Yale University to become the head of her college at Oxford. She spoke of the challenges facing Yale's libraries over the last 10 years that she served there in the emerging age of the Internet. And it was remarkable to hear how similar the challenges she faced are to those that we do here at the Society Library on a smaller scale. She told of running out of space for books and arranging off-site storage, the achievement of retrospective conversion of their catalog, a task that Barbara Stanton helped accomplish in timely fashion some years ago, the increasing allocation of funds to electronic resources, and the challenge of dealing with shrinking budgets at a time of massive cutbacks. A few helpful messages rang through in her talk. She underscored the importance for libraries of embracing all formats, both harnessing the power and inevitability of electronic materials and systems, while cherishing and cultivating the pleasure and importance of the printed book. And she also spoke of the need libraries fulfill as physical spaces, not just as repositories for books, but as gathering places for intellectual stimulation, reflection, writing, and reading, particularly important at a time when the Internet tends to isolate us at the very time that it provides electronic connection. And especially meaningful to me was Ms. Prochaska's emphasis on the importance of maintaining a skilled, educated, and capable staff, which she identified as the primary ingredient of a successful library. The multiple roles that the Society Library fills in our lives was nicely illustrated by the flurry of news coverage this past weekend about our first president's apparent failure to return two books to our circulation desk in the early days of the Republic in 1789. What is remarkable to me about his story is not just the neat irony that the man who could tell no lie seems to have neglected to return a library book or pay a fine. What is most interesting is how the germ of this news story in 2010 was incubated and disseminated. Our own Carolyn Waters was having a dinner, apparently, with a friend who's a reporter at the Daily News, and was telling him about our charging ledger and the evident fact that two books checked out to President Washington are no longer in our collection. The reporter wrote quite a charming piece about it, which was also disseminated on the online version of the news, where it was picked up by the television and radio stations and bloggers and media as far away as the BBC, which interviewed Mark Bartlett for one of their radio broadcasts yesterday, and the paper of record in Nigeria. All of this within the course of 2 days. What took the library over 150 years to figure out from its charging ledger, which had been misplaced for about that period of time, and another 75 years to document by determining that one of the checked out volumes was indeed missing from our 14-volume set of Law of Nations, took a matter of hours to ricochet through the information, electronic information ether. So just as we are proud of our association with our founding fathers, we are subject to the speed and lack of control over dissemination of information through the internet. I'm confident that we can and will both cherish our heritage and embrace the power of electronic information while preserving the spirit that makes us a unique cultural resource. Thank you. Now, George Frelinghuysen has a treasurer's report for us.
When I stood before you last year, financial sky was literally falling. The stock market had touched a multi-year low in March of 2009, and the financial landscape was fraught with uncertainty. And since that time, the financial markets have staged a remarkable recovery, and the libraries weathered this storm and ended 2009 in strong condition. For the year end December 31st, 2009, the New York Society Library recorded an operating surplus of $221,000 prior to non-cash charges. This compares with a surplus of $138,000, which we budgeted for the year. On the revenue side, there were several positive developments. While the number of library members was down slightly from the prior year, 3,147 versus 3,180 in 2008, revenues from membership subscriptions increased year over year and did better than budget. In addition, we recorded 44 new members compared with 38 the year before. The annual appeal increased 12% over 2008. And easily surpassed our budgeted goal. A gift, total of 843 gifts were received in 2009 against 800 in 2008, and the top four categories represented 69% of all funds raised compared to 67% in the previous year. On behalf of the board, I would like to express our appreciation to all the membership for your continued generous support of the library. It means a tremendous amount. Operating expenses were slightly above budget due to some unexpected expenses relating to building services and slightly higher staff expense. The library continues to pay close attention to expense control. Endowment income provides the largest source of support for the library's operations. It covers 60% of our operating expenses. In 2009, the value of the library's endowment rebounded with the rest of the market. The value of our endowment increased by about 14.5% over the course of the year. Despite the improved performance, the endowment draw will trend lower over the next several years as it is calculated on the rolling average of the prior 3 years. As a result, the library will continue to be faced with challenges in 2011 and 2012. Much of the planning in the coming year will be on ways to meet these challenges without sacrificing the level of service that we offer to our membership. Thank you, and I now want to turn it over to Mark for his report.
Well, good evening and welcome, everyone. So great to have so many people here, and I'm very happy to see some of our committee members as well. I see Lucien in the back. Maggie Jackson, and I believe Helen Everts is here as well. She stepped out. Let me begin tonight with what I normally close with, which is kind of a round of thank yous and some congratulations. It continues to be a real pleasure to serve as the 18th head librarian of the Society Library. It's rare to have a job where you can say that you're the 18th of something in 256 years, so it really is a treat. I thank Charles Berry, our chairman, and George Frelinghuysen and the Board of Trustees for all the support that they give us as a staff and give me as the head librarian. They counsel me and help me in so many ways that I often forget to stop and thank them. The members of the staff do make the library the wonderful place that it is. They are, in many ways, why our members keep coming back. I'd like to thank each of the staff members for their service and professionalism over the last year, a year that we all know has not been without challenges, some pitfalls, some joyful moments, and some opportunities. I'd like to thank the committee members of the library who work so hard on our behalf on a volunteer basis, and our volunteers who help us out, Edmi Wright, who is with us tonight, and Jules Cohen, who I believe is not with us tonight. I also want to thank Harry Abarca, who is here on our left, and please thank Harry tonight when you have a chance to have a drink with Harry, because Harry deserves a real round of applause for the work that he did stepping in as our acting building superintendent while John McEwen was out with a leg injury earlier this year. Thank you, Harry, for your grace and consistency in the last year. Harry and John together are a great team, and they take care of a building that, as you all know, has its creaks and pains. It has some wonderful things about it, but it has takes a lot of hours to do what we do here, and everything from setting up for events, tearing down events, dealing with events like our recent exhibition opening of Literary Lives, which brought in so many people to the library and was a challenge for us to organize, but went off very smoothly, and that's in part because of the work of John and Harry. I'd also like to thank our comptroller, Stan Weinman, who's here tonight, and Stanley, thank you for all you do with helping us manage the money. I also wanted to say one final thank you to our very loyal development and membership assistant, Diane Srebnick. Diane plays such an integral role in communicating to our over 3,100 members and shareholders. She maintains order in our development records, and she is really doing a lot of new work us that we've kind of thrown at her in the last couple of years with writing foundation applications, attending and taking minutes at meetings, and also, as Joan and I were chatting over lunch today, really helping to create vision for some of the fundraising and development things we are doing with writing annual appeal letters and working with the development committee. So thank you, Diane. And finally, I wanted to say some congratulations to three of the staff members who, some are here tonight, Andrew Corbin from Circulation, Rachel Henry of the Children's Library, and Matt Haugen of Systems and Cataloging, who are our most recent graduates from library school programs in Greater New York. So congratulations to the new librarians. I have a few highlights of the year that I wanted to share. And as you know, picking highlights out of 12 months is very hard when we do so many things in this library. But I did want to celebrate the New York City Book Awards, which was a real success last year with one winner, Skyscraper in the City by Gail Fenske. This year, the Book Awards jury has been chaired by our longtime juror, Roger Pasquier, who also works with us on the library's development committee, and I'd like to thank Roger for all his hard work, as well as the other jurors. We do have some new jurors on the book jury, Joe Drake, John Hargraves, Bobby Lee, and Trustee Lawrence Burgreen, and we still have space for the event, which is going to be a real celebration with the number of winners that we have this year, so please come on May the 5th for a nice evening. Our Young Writers Awards will happen 2 weeks after the Book Awards on the 19th, I believe. And we're really happy to have the underwriting support once again from Dr. Paul Wagner and Jeanette Sarkazian-Wagner, who have offered to underwrite the Young Writers Awards for the second year in a row. I wanted to reflect a little bit on the success that we've had with something that's quite new in the library in the last couple of years, and in particular in the last year, and that's with the writing life, and more generally, writers' services in the library. Carolyn Waters, who acts as our writers' services librarian, has really steered the ship on this, and I want to thank you, Carolyn, for all your work. It's been a spectacular year. For those of you who may not remember some of the details of the writing life and how it fits into our overall programming, back in the winter and spring of 2009, we started a daytime Wittridge Room series, Tuesdays at 10 a.m., geared towards the library's member writer community. We invite the member writers, but any members can actually sign up and come to the talks if they wish to. We publicize it in our events calendar. Our main challenge with the space is that the more popular the Writing Life events get in the Wittridge Room, we're filling the room to capacity and more. Due to the strong response to the talks that we had in the first series, we extended it through the through 2009 and 10, and since January this year, the daytime series has been underwritten by our former trustee, Jenny Lawrence. We've had lots of really exciting programs on the changing face of journalism, programs on dealing with permissions and copyrights, self-publishing, working with an editor, the Google book settlement, and most recently, a packed house in this room Tuesday morning recently with Gretchen Rubin and a talk on social networking for writers. In the past year, we've also had two open mic nights, which some people kind of associate open mic nights with going to a tavern and drinking pitchers of beer and hearing all kinds of crazy things. But the open mic nights in our library have really fit the culture of the library, and they've been very well received by the writer community, who have been able to find a venue to share their work. We plan to have another open mic night and perhaps another one and make it a regular feature throughout the year. In January, the library hosted a literary magazine salon. It was a first and a kind of germ of an idea that came from a couple of members and from Deborah Pease, who is a supporter of the library. It was a real special evening with readings that were introduced by the editors of three local literary journals, One Story, Jubilat, and A Public Space. And we had three writers who read portions of their work, and we had a chance for a social occasion and mingling, and it was just a great evening. And also in January, the library, after 256 years, and after the 8 to 10 years or however long they have been around, we entered the world of blogging, and we finally have a blog in the library, which is The Writing Life at NYSocLib. And it's a blog for and about member writers of the library. Anyone here, anyone in the world, can read the blog. You can find it linked both from the library's homepage and from the Facebook site. Carolyn is doing the composition and editing and structure for it, and it's been very creative and interesting so far. And we average about 200 page loads of the blog site every week, and that should be growing as well. Last year, I told you about some of the partnerships that had worked, and this year we've continued some of these ongoing relationships with, of course, WNET 13 and our very successful authors series. We had a second year of performances of Auden's For the Time Being, and that program sponsored with Affinity Collaborative Theater. We had two performances last December, great evenings, and we're talking again with them about what we will do as a collaboration in the future. We also had a little bit of a different collaboration in the last year, which didn't involve events and space here in the members' room. It actually involved a relationship with a school in the neighborhood, the Rudolf Steiner School. And the grade 11 and 12 students of Steiner have had their memberships in our library paid by the school, and this allows them to use the library, check out books, and search our databases. And so far, the use has been, what should we say, Jane, modest, and not too much of a stress on either the collection or the staff. So it's been a win-win situation for the library and Steiner, and it has been a source of revenue for us. Last June, we started a new tradition with a new members' party, and we had remarks by Charles Berry and our very good neighbor from down the street, Tom Wolfe. Mr. Wolfe reflected in his remarks, "The line here is that society in the library's name has nothing to do with class, but just look around you. This is an aristocracy of taste and discernment." Our second annual new members party is being scheduled for June 1st, I believe, and this year I think we have over 120 or 130 people who have joined in the last year who will be inviting. I wanted to reflect a little bit on some of what you're seeing around me, which is material from the library. And we did have a couple of interesting things happen with the library in print in the last year. One book that was actually published that featured the library is over on the table. And it's a book that was published in 2009, authored by Stuart A. Murray. And it's a 300-page volume called The Library and Illustrated History. He has a very long chapter on the library in colonial America. And Mr. Murray in this book puts us in the context of the growth of subscription libraries in the United States, which of course started with Benjamin Franklin and the Library Company of Philadelphia in 1731. So have a look at the Stuart Murray book. Christopher Gray's Where Fusty is Fabulous, which I think I would assume everyone in the room did get to see when it was in the paper in early March, was met with lots of positive feedback, interesting comments, and yes, some new members, and many people dropping in quite quickly and asking to tour the building. I didn't actually have a chance to let the board and the rest of the staff know this, but one interesting thing that did happen after the Gray article is descendants of the Green, of the Green Alcove, actually came for a tour about 3 weeks ago with Christopher one night. We were actually having an event in here, and Christopher, as you all know, when he gives people a tour, he takes quite a while, and it was a rather expansive walk around the building, and I did have a chance to meet the descendants of Mr. Green, and so I hope to have them back, and we're hoping that they'll join the library as well. But they were quite thrilled to read the New York Times article and then come and actually have a look at the Green Alcove. In 2009, our members were busy readers. We circulated, and this is a rather shocking figure for many people, 98,000 volumes. That was an increase of over 9% from 2008, which is quite a jump for this library. 15% of our circulation was from the children's collection. As Patrick Rayner noted in his department's annual report, recent prize-winning novels like Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, Colin McCann's Let the Great World Spin, and Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kittredge were very popular. Mystery and thriller readers have continued to line up for books in this library, and as you all know, the dragon books, as some people call them, the Stieg Larsson novels in Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, have been extremely popular here. Along with mysteries by Charles Todd, Joseph Finder, and Louise Penny. The circulation department continued to be very busy with its many varied and valued services, including the work that Susan Chan does for us with housebound and long-distance patrons. I understand that we help Susan build her upper body strength with her muscles by asking her to send over 300 packages in the last year serving our housebound members. So thank you, Susan. By working in the library, we do get a kind of bird's eye view of what people read from day to day. But this past year, the library actually spent some time looking back and learning again what members borrowed and read long ago. A grant from the Delmas Foundation in 2008 allowed us to continue the analysis of the library's first charging ledger. We've learned some interesting things doing the painstaking analysis of the ledger. Here are some examples. In the first ledger, Reverend William Lynn, a very well-known man of his time, borrowed 232 volumes between 1789 and 1792. Elizabeth de Peyster borrowed 84 volumes, and Richard Varick borrowed 76 volumes, all quite busy readers in this period. We also know, and this is a little bit of an interesting claim to fame when we talk about ourselves compared to the Boston Athenaeum, we actually had 14 female members, women who were registered under their own accounts, and they included Catherine Bradford, Elizabeth de Peyster, Sarah Franklin, no relation to Benjamin, Isabella Graham, Sarah Livingston, and a handful of others. One such member was Henrietta Maria Colden. She was a very prominent widow here in New York City. Her husband was Richard Colden, who passed away in 1777. She was very well acquainted with the Hamiltons, and she was also very well acquainted with the Burrs. She read a variety of titles, Rousseau's works, Goldsmith's History of the Earth and Animated Nature, a title by James Ferguson, Lectures on Mechanics, Hydrostatics, Pneumatics, and Optics, and a novel by Jean-Jacques Rutledge with a rather peculiar title, which I have to read out, The Englishman's Fortnight in Paris, or The Art of Ruining Himself There in a Few Days. I've been reading more about Mr. Rutledge in the last few days. He's actually in American National Biography, and I have learned in the last few days that his principal claim to fame is that he was a promoter of English literature in France. The handout that you have tonight on your chair is a sampling of titles from the first charging ledger analysis, and on the flip side, some of the more interesting titles that have been discovered by our head of cataloging, Laura O'Keefe, in her recataloging of the Hammond collection. So have a look at both sides of the page. I could go on about the charging ledger, and it'll probably come up again in next year's report, but suffice it to say that the ledger work is quite fascinating, and I really want to thank the team that's worked on it, Arvid Kaprielian, Tim Conley, Matt Haugen, Perry Pignetti, our head of systems, Ingrid Richter, and Derek Stadler. Next fall, we will be having a charging ledger launch event, and it will be an event in this room where we will bring out the conserved and treated physical charging ledger that we now keep under lock and key, and we'll also be demonstrating the digital ledger, which will have its own life on the internet and will be available to anyone in the world. We are also going to seek further underwriting and support to continue the ledger and archives work. It's a very important part of the library, and I think one of the real opportunities for us to move more into foundation support. It's been a while in my report since I've actually mentioned the art collection, so I did want to share one colorful thread of the last year, which is a story about an item that's against this wall, and you'll have to look after at the etching. A few months back, a gentleman named Lars Krog, he's a 50-ish man from New Haven, Connecticut, he offered to sell the library a pen and ink drawing of our University Place building. The pen and ink drawing was done by Vernon Howe Bailey, whose book I've brought up here today. It's a book called Magical City, and you can look at it and see some of his wonderful work. Bailey was born in Camden, New Jersey in 1874 and studied in Pennsylvania. His best-known drawings are of street scenes of some of the major cities of the world, London, Oxford, Cambridge, and New York. The story is that the New York Sun commissioned a daily series of drawings called Intimate Sketches of New York City. And as you'll see tonight when you have a look at it, it's a beautiful, one-of-a-kind item. We have the only copy, it is the original, and one that we were able to purchase with a small amount of money, financial support from an anonymous archives fund that was established in 2008. Mr. Krog, just so you'll know, he ended up with the etchings because he's the grandson of William Duart, who was the publisher and editor of the New York Sun. And we'll, of course, have it framed and displayed somewhere in the library at an appropriate place, perhaps on the fifth floor when we open again. I wanted to reflect a little bit on challenges in the next year, and there are many of them. I would predict that we'll be having increased circulation. That seems to be the trend. The demand for reading and writing spaces, something that I think is quite crucial, finding the balance of silence is golden, and this is a working library for our members, which is not always an easy thing to do. We will also have the challenge of engaging our members and discovering what they value most about the library. I also think we have the challenge of improving the organization and working on enhancing and streamlining the content on the library's website and in our related publications like the annual reports and our newsletters. I would also maintain that we do need to work on maintaining the integrity of the staff and exploring such issues as health coverage and salary equity. On the long term, I think it's really an important issue for the library and for the sake of the staff. We've had a good year, and I think we've really had a great year. We've had more books added, we've had readings, discussions, we've launched an offsite storage program, Project Cicero, we've had some interesting media attention, we've had record attendance at our Literary Lives exhibition opening, and on our website and through YouTube, we stored over 20 audio and video recordings of events. Pericles once wrote, "What you leave behind is not what is engraved in stone monuments, but what is woven into the lives of others." I hope that our mission, if accomplished, is this very thing. With the power of words, the experience of community, and the comfortable home that we provide here at 79th and Madison, let's create even a better library in the next year. Thanks for listening.